Heretics, Chapter 1, Introductory Remarks on the Importance of Orthodoxy. Nothing more strangely indicates an enormous and silent evil of modern society than the extraordinary use which is made nowadays of the word orthodox. In former days, the heretic was proud of not being a heretic. It was the kingdoms of the world and the police and the judges who were heretics. He was orthodox. He had no pride in having rebelled against them. They had rebelled against him. The armies with their cruel security, kings with their cold faces, the decorous processes of state, the reasonable processes of law, all these, like sheep, had gone astray. The man was proud of being orthodox, was proud of being right. If he stood alone in the howling wilderness, he was more than a man, he was a church. He was the center of the universe. It was round him that the stars swung. All the tortures torn out of forgotten hells could not make him admit that he was heretical. But a few modern phrases have made him boast of it. He says with a conscious laugh, "I suppose I am very heretical," and looks round for applause. The word heresy not only means no longer being wrong, it practically means being clear-headed and courageous. The word orthodoxy not only no longer means right, it practically means being wrong. All this can mean one thing, and one thing only. It means that people care less for whether they are philosophically right. For obviously, a man ought to confess himself crazy before he confesses himself heretical. The bohemian with a red tie ought to pique himself on his orthodoxy. The dynamiter laying a bomb ought to feel that, whatever else he is, at least he is orthodox. It is foolish, generally speaking, for a philosopher to set fire to another philosopher in Smithfield Market because they do not agree in their theory of the universe. That was done very frequently in the last decadence of the Middle Ages, and it failed altogether in its object. But there is one thing that is infinitely more absurd and unpractical than burning a man for his philosophy. This is the habit of saying that his philosophy does not matter, and this is done universally in the 20th century. In the decadence of the great revolutionary period. General theories are everywhere condemned. The doctrine of the rights of man is dismissed with the doctrine of the fall of man. Atheism itself is too theological for us today. Revolution itself is too much of a system. Liberty itself is too much of a restraint. We will have no generalizations. Mr. Bernard Shaw has put the view in a perfect epigram. Quote, "The golden rule is that there is no golden rule." End of quote. We are more and more to discuss details in art, politics, and literature. A man's opinion on tram cars matters. His opinion on Botticelli matters. His opinion on all things does not matter. He may turn over and explore million objects, but he must not find that strange object, the universe. For if he does, he will have a religion and be lost. Everything matters except everything. Examples are scarcely needed of this total levity on the subject of cosmic philosophy. Examples are scarcely needed to show that whatever else we think of as affecting practical affairs, we do not think it matters whether a man is a pessimist or an optimist, a Cartesian or a Hegelian, a materialist or a spiritualist. Let me, however, take a random instance. At any innocent tea table, we may easily hear a man say, quote, "Life is not worth living," unquote. We regard it as we regard the statement that it is a fine day. Nobody thinks that it can possibly have any serious effect on the man or on the world. And yet, if that utterance were really believed, the world would stand on its head. Murderers would be given medals for saving men from life. Firemen would be denounced for keeping men from death. Poisons would be used as medicines. Doctors would be called in when people were well. The Royal Humane Society would be rooted out like a horde of assassins. Yet we never speculate as to whether the conversational pessimist will strengthen or disorganize society, for we are convinced that theories do not matter. This was certainly not the idea of those who introduced our freedom. When the old liberals removed the gags from all the heresies, their idea was that religious and philosophical discoveries might thus be made. Their view was that cosmic truth was so important that everyone ought to bear independent testimony. The modern idea is that cosmic truth is so unimportant that it cannot matter what anyone says. The former freed inquiry as men loose a noble hound. The latter frees inquiry as men fling back into the sea a fish unfit for eating. Never has there been so little discussion about the nature of men as now, when, for the first time, anyone can discuss it. The old restriction meant that only the Orthodox were allowed to discuss religion. Modern liberty means that nobody is allowed to discuss it. Good taste, the last and vilest of human superstitions, has succeeded in silencing us where all the rest have failed. 60 years ago, it was bad taste to be an avowed atheist. Then came the Bradlaughs, the last religious men, the last men who cared about God, but they could not alter it. It is still bad taste to be an avowed atheist, but their agony has achieved just this, that now it is equally bad taste to be an avowed Christian. Emancipation has only locked the saint in the same tower of silence as the heresiarch. Then we talk about Lord Anglesey and the weather and call it the complete liberty of all the creeds. But there are some people, nevertheless, and I am one of them, who think that the most practical and important thing about a man is still his view of the universe. We think that for a landlady considering a lodger, it is important to know his income, but still more important to know his philosophy. We think that for a general about to fight an enemy, it is important to know the enemy's numbers, but still more important to know the enemy's philosophy. We think the question is not whether the theory of the cosmos affects matters, but whether, in the long run, anything else affects them. In the 15th century, men cross-examined and tormented a man because he preached some immoral attitude. In the 19th century, we feted and flattered Oscar Wilde because he preached such an attitude, and then broke his heart in penal servitude because he carried it out. It may be a question which of the two methods was more cruel. There can be no kind of question which was the more ludicrous. The age of the Inquisition has not at least the disgrace of having produced a society which made an idol of the very same man for preaching the very same things which it made him a convict for practicing. Now, in our time, philosophy or religion, our theory, that is, about ultimate things, has been driven out more or less simultaneously from two fields which it used to occupy. General ideals used to dominate literature. They have been driven out by the cry of art for art's sake. General ideals used to dominate politics. They have been driven out by the cry of efficiency, which may roughly be translated as politics for politics' sake. Persistently, for the last 20 years, the ideals of order or liberty have dwindled in our books. The ambitions of wit and eloquence have dwindled in our parliaments. Literature has purposely become less political. Politics have purposely become less literary. General theories of the relation of things have thus been extruded from both, and we are in a position to ask, what have we gained or lost by this extrusion? Is literature better? Is politics better for having discarded the moralist and the philosopher? When everything about a people is for the time growing weak and ineffective, it begins to talk about efficiency. So it is that when a man's body is a wreck, he begins, for the first time, to talk about health. Vigorous organisms talk not about their processes, but about their aims. There cannot be any better proof of the physical efficiency of a man than that he talks cheerfully of a journey to the end of the world. And there cannot be any better proof of the practical efficiency of a nation than that it talks constantly of a journey to the end of the world, a journey to the judgment day and the New Jerusalem. There can be no stronger sign of a coarse material health than the tendency to run after high and wild ideals. It is in the first exuberance of infancy that we cry for the moon. None of the strong men in the strong ages would have understood what you meant by working for efficiency. Hildebrand would have said that he was working not for efficiency, but for the Catholic Church. Danton would have said that he was working not for efficiency, but for liberty, equality, and fraternity. even if the ideal of such men were simply the ideal of kicking a man downstairs. They thought of the end like men, not of the process like paralytics. They did not say, efficiently elevating my right leg, using, you will notice, the muscles of the thigh and calf, which are in excellent order, their feeling was quite different. They were so filled with the beautiful vision of the man lying flat at the foot of the staircase that in that ecstasy the rest followed in a flash. In practice, the habit of generalizing and idealizing did not by any means mean worldly weakness.